Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Kathleen Buckwalter, a geriatric mental health nurse, retired professor with the University of Iowa, and has a current affiliation with Oklahoma University Health Sciences Center. And we will be discussing progressively lowered stress threshold. Now, for caregivers, I know some of the hardest moments come when you're dealing with challenging behaviors in the person with dementia, and we're constantly looking for strategies to avoid these behaviors or manage these behaviors. And I think we're well-versed in these strategies of having a daily routine, avoiding change, avoiding overstimulation and overwhelm, but really the underpinnings of these behaviors is progressively lowered stress threshold. Now, come with me on a little journey. A few years back, when I first came to Banner Alzheimer's Institute, I met one of our clinicians, Dr. Jerry Hall, and she shared with me progressively lowered stress threshold, or PLST. And this was a light bulb moment for me. Like I said, we know these strategies to help prevent behaviors, but they just seemed kind of random to me. They didn't quite make sense. And a PLST brought it all together for me. It's aha, that's why we want to implement these strategies day to day. It changes the way you see and understand behaviors and the way you respond to them. And I'll never forget how Jerry phrased it when she taught me about it. She says, as the person with dementia, their disease progresses, their tolerance for stress decreases. And stress is anything that requires thought.
Anything that requires thought. So simple. And we don't realize how many things actually require thought and cause that stress. Things that we might take for granted, like the process of brushing our teeth or the process of cooking or following a recipe or trying to use the microwave or a phone. And dementia can complicate things and make them so stressful.
And even more than these processes that were or tasks that the person is engaging in, I think broadening that mindset of what is stress into like even sensory information that's coming in.
Sure.
The amount of words that are being used in a conversation. What is the temperature in the room? What other sounds are competing in that moment? So I'm really excited to share PLST with our listeners today, and we have gone right to the source. Welcome, Dr. Buckwalter. We're so excited to have this conversation with you today.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So before we get started, I want to learn a little bit more about you. Can you tell us about your journey and what led you to connect with the dementia community?
It was kind of a long and winding road. I wasn't purposely setting out to have a career that involved care of persons with dementia, but I must have had something in my background that led me to be intrigued by the concept of people with cognitive impairment and how to improve their quality of life. Because as an undergraduate student, so this would have been, I was an undergraduate at the University of Iowa from 67 to 71. And along the way, I took an independent study at our Institute for Gerontology and I wrote a paper for that course on dementia. And it was a relatively new concept at that time. Still, people didn't understand what it was. They thought it was due to hardening of the arteries. So there were a lot of misconceptions. I was fascinated with the whole relatively new designation of dementia. But then after I graduated, I did a 3-year stint in the Navy during the Vietnam War. So I really didn't deal with older adults or their caregivers during that period, came back to school, got a master's degree in psych mental health nursing. And again, there were no gerontology courses being offered in the early 70s at most institutions, including the University of Iowa. I went on from there to get my doctorate at the University of Illinois in Chicago College of Nursing. And my dissertation research was on discharge planning for people with depression, in keeping with my interest in psych mental health nursing. Then I joined the faculty in 1980 after completing my doctorate. And the dean said to me two things. If you want to advance, you need to get a focus and you need to get some external funding. Now, I was so interested in so many things that I was doing research and publishing on people with bipolar disorder in work environments, so occupational health sorts of things. I had a couple of babies during that time, and I was interested in postpartum depression. She said, you got to find a focus. And this is how you can have a career, I guess, by fiat, if you're open to opportunities. And I was at a lawn party celebrating the 100th anniversary of a home of a colleague of mine. And at this lawn party, while sipping some lemonade, I was talking with one of the university officials in our division of sponsored programs. His name was Jay Semmel. And I said, Jay, the dean says I need to get a focus and I need to get some external funding, which, by the way, was almost unheard of in 1980 because there were few doctorally prepared nurses and external funding opportunities for nurses were few and far between. But a couple of weeks after talking to Jay in Campus Mail with a little smiley face poster on it, comes apply for a Geriatric Mental Health Academic Award, which was a career development award through the National Institute of Mental Health. And I met all the eligibility criteria. And so I thought, well, this is the answer to my prayers. It's a focus, geriatric mental health, and it's external funding. It was for 3 years of support from the National Institute of Mental Health. So I wrote the grant, submitted it in, I believe, October of 1982. But I was so naive about the whole grants process and the National Institutes of Health and how that went, that when a friend came by my office late one Friday and said, whatever happened to that grant application you submitted? I said, well, I guess I didn't get it because I haven't heard anything. I didn't know that it took 9 months and that you had to go through primary levels of review and council levels of review and get priority scores and so forth. But she said, well, you got to call them. So I did. And I found out that, well, they said, this is your priority score. And I didn't even know what a priority score was at the time. So I was truly naive about the grants getting processed, but I was in the fundable range, as they say, and went on to receive funding that July. And I was also very pregnant with my third child, who was born in early September and was supposed to teach summer school. So I had a lot of adjusting to do both personally and professionally, but that's how I got into the area of geriatrics. If the document from sponsored programs had been pediatric mental health career development award, my trajectory would have taken a very different focus. I was lucky enough that it was geriatrics, and I couldn't have designed a career or area of interest that I love more. I'm still very passionate about it many years thereafter. But it was also at this time when I met Jerry Hall, when I was doing my career development award in the mid 80s. And she was my master's student, or I was her advisor in the master's program. And in comes this absolutely blow you away, astute clinician and educator. And it was one of those rare, well, maybe not so rare, but in my case, it was a gift where the student teaches the teacher. In other words, Jerry knew so much more than I did that I was able to partner with her and to help shape or make sense of her astute clinical observations born of her wonderful clinical experiences in geriatric mental health. So we formed, I think, a very useful and cordial partnership. We're still friends to this day. And she is the reason that the PLST model came into being. And it was my good fortune to be her teacher, even though she taught me more than I ever taught her at the time. So that's a little bit of the background.
What an amazing story and great lesson that we can take to be open when looking forward. Now, and I also love hearing about a little bit more about Jerry Hall, because I just have such fond memories of working with her at Banner Alzheimer's, and I too learned so much from her. Now, when it comes to PLST, you've mentioned that there are kind of some assumptions that sort of underlie this model or four principles, if you will.
Yes, well, we made some assumptions, and those assumptions weren't novel to us, but they undergirded the model, the PLST model that was developed. And they came from psychological and stress theories and person environment theories. So we kind of pulled together extant theories at the time in the early 80s that made sense for the population and the settings that we were dealing with. And those four assumptions are: all humans require some control over their person and environment and need some degree of unconditional positive regard, which means that they're accorded dignity and valued as human beings, even if they can't remember your name or what they had for breakfast today, that they're still adults who've lived a long and important, significant life, and they needed to be treated that way. The second assumption is that all behavior is rooted and has meaning. Therefore, even the most catastrophic and stress-related behaviors that persons with dementia exhibit have a cause. And as care providers, it behooves us to try and find the meaning or the roots of that cause and eliminate it or pare it down to change the behaviors. Third, the confused or agitated patient is uncomfortable and should be regarded as frightened. All patients have the right to be comfortable. So this is a quality of life issue, that their behaviors, no matter what they are, biting or spitting or screaming, means that they're uncomfortable. It's their way of expressing that they're scared or frightened. And we, as care providers, need to help them become less frightened and scared. And finally, that the patient exists in the 24-hour continuum, not just when staffing levels are highest on the 7-to-3 shift, but oftentimes in persons with dementia, they are most active late at night, out in the hallways or at home, up trying to get in the car, out in the driveway, and so forth. So we must have a round-the-clock perspective and ability to do with behaviors that may change according to the clock. As you mentioned, there are some principles of care that really are important to the specific interventions or approaches that we use with persons with dementia. And the first, and this is not rocket science, this is good care provision, but they need to be articulated. Maximize the level of safe function by supporting all areas of loss in a prosthetic manner. And by that, we mean you need to anticipate what the person with dementia may no longer be able to do. For example, if they're turning on the bath water to give themselves a bath in the home setting, you may need to feel the bath temperature before they get in, because they won't think to test the water and they might get in and scald themselves. So you're acting prosthetically. You're acting in a supportive manner, trying to support the losses, the thinking, the cognitive changes that have deteriorated because of the brain disease. Again, providing the patient with unconditional positive regard. This is, again, the notion that we all deserve respect and dignity in our communication, in the way we interact, to be treated with respect accorded to any human being. Using behaviors as kind of the barometer to indicate the anxiety and avoidance and determine limits of levels of activity and stimuli. So take your cue from the person with dementia. If they're looking uncomfortable, they're tapping their toe, they're getting restless, they're trying to leave the place where you are, this suggests that they're anxious and uncomfortable. And you need to look around the environment and see what's going on that might be triggering this response. The fourth principle is to teach caregivers, and this would be both formal, that is staff in institutional setting or assisted living facility, as well as informal, that might be kin or neighbors who are caring for the person with dementia, to listen to the patient, to evaluate their verbal and nonverbal responses. So there's a lot that's communicated nonverbally in this way by the person with dementia. They may not always be able to tell you exactly how they feel or what's going on, but you can learn to read it in their behavior. Modify the environment to support their losses and to enhance safety, and provide ongoing education, support, care, and problem solving for caregivers.
Dr. Buchwalter, thank you so much for your research. And I understand that this model of care, PLST, has been validated globally. And to hear you share about it, to our listeners, you might just want to go back and review those principles over and over. One of the things that you had mentioned was the behavior barometer. That in itself is a gold nugget. And I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit more about how stress impacts a person with dementia and what the most common stressors are.
People with dementia, well, we all are, subject to stressors throughout the day, but people who have cognitive and affective and conative, which means planning, losses as a result of changes in the brain due to dementia are particularly vulnerable to stress. Some of the main sources of stress for persons with dementia are fatigue. And so let's say that you're going to take a family vacation in the car, rather than driving from here to well, I'm in Iowa, so from Iowa to Colorado, which is like a 12-hour drive on Interstate 80, you would want to break up that trip into at least two, if not three segments, so that the person doesn't become too fatigued and the discomforting behaviors emerge. Think about what you're asking the person with dementia to do and how long, and then chunk it into smaller, less time consuming activities. Multiple and competing stimuli. Oh, this is where, just think of like a dining hall in a nursing home where you've got the loudspeaker announcing that meds are being delivered. You've got noise and confusion of people serving the trays. There may be a public, in addition to the public address system, there may be music playing on a television or radio. There are too many people in a small space and too many things going on at once. They're eating dinner. They're taking their medications. There may be mealtime entertainment. So this is the chronically confusing environment. And it's very difficult for the person, because of the brain changes associated with Alzheimer's disease, to correctly interpret all of this chaotic stimuli and process it and make sense of it, and therefore respond what we would consider to be appropriately. They may respond, in fact, by just pushing themselves away from the table, getting up and walking out of the room, which is a really appropriate response in many respects, but not to our way of thinking, but to their way of thinking, because they may think that the public address system is the voice of God coming down from the ceiling, or misinterpret other stimuli in that way. There are physical stresses that we're all prone to, but are particularly adverse in persons with dementia. These include other illnesses. And sometimes it just amazes me that if somebody has a dementia, we stop thinking, do they need a breast exam, or an annual mammogram or to have their labs drawn or an annual physical assessment, because they still can get breast cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or other painful diseases. That will be another source of stress for them. So we want to look at illnesses. We also want to look at the medications that are used to treat those illnesses, because the adverse side effects can be horrendous. And so one of the real blessings in inpatient facilities is the consulting pharmacist, who will take a look at the med record and say, oh, I see that the antibiotic is interacting with the pain medication. I'm just making these up. And so we need to put them on a different antibiotic. Or I see that the person has to be awakened every 4 hours in the middle of the night in order to get this particular medication. And that's disturbing their sleep. And that's feeding into their behavioral problems. Other physical stressors, that because the person doesn't always articulate their discomfort, is hunger or thirst or discomfort from something like an ingrown toenail that we may not even notice that they're limping or they aren't that mobile to begin with, but it's very painful. And they may tell you in their own way that it's painful by if you come up from behind and by throwing out their arm and slamming you across the face. And that's not because they hate you or they're aggressive, vicious people. It's because they're in such discomfort, such pain from that ingrown toenail, and they don't know how to articulate. So the only way they can let you know how bad they feel is by striking out. Also, a big stressor for older adults with dementia are the capacity to adapt to changes. And they also concurrently face so many changes. They can face, especially in an inpatient environment, changes in caregiver, where there's a new person every day who makes them bathe and get dressed, rather than being assigned a consistent caregiver. Changes in routine. This is not the time to be innovative and change it up and have a bath at 10 o'clock one day and at 6 p.m. the next. People with dementia rely on overlearned habits and consistency and routinization. And so it's best to have things as similar from day to day as possible. Also, changes in the environment. And this can be really even positive changes like redecorating, where the person no longer understands their environment or what those lovely pictures of tigers with the huge eyes are doing staring at them from the wall of your newly redecorated living room. So any change in the environment, and this includes going from home to nursing home, major, major change in environment, can be unsettling, can be difficult to understand, and cause stress in the person with dementia. Another one I'll mention is demands to exceed beyond their abilities. That can include asking them to make decisions that are too complex or too open-ended, like what do you want to eat? What do you want to wear? These open-ended questions many times are so challenging that the person responds by becoming agitated. If you give them a choice, respect their dignity as an individual by still allowing them to choose what they wear or eat, but help them along, act prosthetically, that term I used earlier, would you like to wear the blue dress or the red dress today? And let them choose. That's still preserving their dignity, but it helps with the decision-making, which is imperative in dementia. Or at the grocery store, when you're trying to pick out some kind of cereal and just confronted with a wall of different brands and just saying, well, I've always liked Raisin Bran. What do you think? Should we get some Raisin Bran? And then they can say, yes, I like Raisin Bran, or no, I don't like that. So they're still involved in the choice, but they don't have to negotiate this wall of choices, which is very difficult for them to do. Asking them to complete tasks that are outside of their abilities. And that could be something like, let's say I don't even know if there are soap operas on anymore, but there used to be like General Hospital or something like that. And say you watch it very pleasurably, watch the soap opera in the early afternoon, with the person with dementia, but then grilling them afterwards, like, well, who do you think killed the leading actress or that sort of thing. Well, they don't know. And by pressing them, asking them to respond, it's only going to take away from the pleasure of watching something together. So just it is challenging and confronting them rather than supporting what they've lost. So don't ask them to exceed their abilities, just support whatever level they're at functionally, cognitively, knowing that that can change from day to day. So something they forget on Monday, they may remember on Wednesday, and they may be lucid one day and very confused the next, and that's just part of the disease process too. And the final source of stress is negative and restrictive feedback. Lots of times if I've been called to consult in a residential care facility, for example, I would just go to the nurse's station, close my eyes and listen. And many times what I would hear is, don't do that, get out of there. You don't belong in the linen closet. And it's the tone of voice as well as what's being said. So the person may not understand the words. They don't know why they shouldn't be in the linen closet or even what the linen closet is, but they get that they've screwed up. They've done something wrong just by the tone of voice. Other messages that we give, like your parents are dead, they can't come and visit you, when they express a desire to go talk to their mother or father. Or very commonly, I want to go home. I want to go home. This is your home now. Or no, you're not going to work. When the individual, those are overlearned habits. So I live in a university town, and there's one care facility that has a lot of retired university professors. And for them, holding faculty meetings at 10 o'clock in the morning was a lifelong habit. And so this one individual would go around and try and haul the other residents out of their room and make them come into the staff meeting, his faculty meeting, and push people out of their wheelchairs and so forth. It was just a disaster. And he was ready to be strapped in his bed with a 4-point restraint and a little howl dog going in his veins. When people realized what he was trying to do was have his faculty meeting, and he felt that the other residents who weren't coming were resisting him. So we gave him a podium and some scrap paper, and then wheeled people in at 10 o'clock in the morning for 15 minutes or so. And he held his largely incoherent faculty meeting, but that appeased him. He was doing his job. And so that terrible behavior that was upsetting to both residents and staff diminished. So those are the main stressors that I wanted to share with you.
Dr. Buckwalter, I think you've given us so much incredible information to digest. And what I like about this model is, in a way, it's simplicity, where you spoke of, you know, fatigue is so difficult for people with dementia and they're more easily fatigued. Well, then the solution to that is the converse. It's the opposite. We have to work on managing fatigue and making sure we infuse the day with rest periods. Too much demand. If they're feeling overwhelmed, well, close your eyes and take in all of the stimulation that they are. Is there a way to tone it down? I like that this model too puts the blame on the stress and not necessarily the specific activity that maybe the behavior is appearing in, or we're not blaming the person either. We're really identifying what is the stress, what is the root. And I think finally, this is an incredibly empowering model for caregivers that takes this sort of unique angle, this non-pharmacological approach to managing these challenging behaviors.
I agree with you completely.
Could you talk to us a little more about sort of the uniqueness of PLST? Because this is, I mean, it stood the test of time. This was the mid-80s that this model came out. And I think, you know, different iterations continue to come forward.
Oh, that's right. There's been a lot of development in the field since we developed the model. But at the time, it had a lot of unique features. If you think about what was going on in terms of policy and care at the time, which is the mid-80s, it's a time when the federal government came in and said, you got to take away those physical and chemical restraints in nursing homes. And it's going to be tied to Medicare and Medicaid resources if you don't. And so staff were just, oh my God, what are we going to do? These people will be wandering the halls. They'll be hooting and hollering in the middle of the night. We don't know what to do. So we were able to provide a non-pharmacological alternative that was grounded in clinical observations as well as other psychological stress and person environment fit theories. It had the concept of individualizing it for the patient and their caregiver, or the resident and their caregiver, was not as well developed as it is today. And the emphasis on quality of life that we really see in what's called person-centered care today, but this was before all those concepts were so popular, importantly popular, but maximizing comfort and safety, because I think every year you read in the front page of the local newspaper that somebody with dementia wanders out of their home and is found in here in Iowa anyway, frozen to death in a cornfield overnight or something equally tragic. So safety is a huge, or turning on the stove and burning down the house, or injuring themselves with an implement they can't remember how to use properly. So safety is important. The fact that it was geared towards both informal and formal caregivers, and it's very practical in terms of intervention with steps to follow, applications across the whole trajectory of the disease from newly diagnosed, probably best fit is with the middle stages of dementia and less so with the end stages. But that knowing that behaviors change as the disease evolves and that we need to change our strategies and approaches to match those changes is important. So we really were trying to prevent or diminish behaviors that were disturbing to caregivers. And why was that important? Because if you don't work with the caregiver, many times they would just say, I can't deal with this anymore. And their health is mental and physical is very important as well. So they would institutionalize the person with dementia. We found that by providing the caregiver with the educational resources, understanding of the disease and strategies to deal with the things they found most disturbing, that we were able to keep people out of nursing homes longer and to enhance the relationship in the caregiving dyad, that is by both increasing the quality of life for the person with dementia and their caregiver. Also unique at that time was that we had a real interprofessional focus. Admittedly, the model was developed and disseminated primarily to nurses initially, but social workers, psychologists, spiritual leaders have used the model since then. And it's really stood the test of time. And the principles and assumptions and strategies that were part of the initial PLST model have been incorporated into many other more recently developed models. And I think maybe the most important message that we were saying in development of the PLST model was Alzheimer's disease is incurable. That was at the time and still is, but it's not untreatable. And there's so much that we can do to preserve and enhance the remaining abilities of the person with the dementia by avoiding unnecessary stress and overstimulation, by treating illness and other complications, and providing education and guidance for families and other caregivers. And that was an important message. And it was a message of hope that was well received. And sometimes, you know, these caregivers say to us, I went to the neurologist, I got the diagnosis, he said, well, there's nothing I can do for you, good luck. And that's not what people need to hear. They need to hear, let me help you understand this disease and how to manage it and your interactions so that both you and the one you're caring for do better.
Wow, Dr. Buckwalter, thank you so much for giving our listeners that sense of hope and strategies to help them better manage day to day. If our listeners want to learn more about progressively lowered stress threshold, is there a website they could visit?
Yes, this is a superb website, and it's called the Best Practices Caregiving Database, developed by the Family Caregiver Alliance in cooperation with the Gerontological Society of America. And what that website features is probably 10 or 12 best practices. And by that, I mean, practices that are evidence-based, that have been validated through research. And on this website, which is capital B, capital P, capital C, for best practice caregiving, .caregiver.org, bpc.caregiver.org, are detailed explanations and resources for the best of the best in terms of evidence-based caregiving models. And I think it's one of the most fantastic resources there is for caregivers. The PLST is among, but certainly not the only model of care that's at this website. And I would recommend it highly.
Today, our conversation has been with Kathleen Buckwalter, a geriatric mental health nurse, and along with her colleague, Jerry Hall, pioneer in the creation of the PLST model to decrease behaviors and increase quality of life. Thank you so much for joining us today and helping us untangle PLST.
Well, it's been my pleasure to talk with you. It gets me excited all over again, even though I'm retired now, just talking about the model. And I'm so glad you mentioned Jerry again, because without her expertise, it simply wouldn't exist.
Thank you so much, Dr. Buckwalter. What a tremendous opportunity, a true gift for us to have you on with us today and to have a conversation with you about your incredible research and your compassionate impact that you've made over all these years. So thank you so much. And thank you, Heather, for another great conversation. And thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.